Hi, Justice Bell.
Hi, Justice Herndon. Thank you for the accommodation.
For sure. So I think Julie may have told you all, but we had an issue come up, so Justice Bell is joining us remotely. I apologize in advance if there's any delay. If she wants to ask any questions at any point in time, I told her just interrupt me or anybody else and kind of give us a high sign. And it may be that on occasion I kind of ask her specifically if she has any questions just as we're moving through argument. On behalf of Mr. Davis, Ms. Reynolds, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Thank you. Katie Reynolds for Mr. Davis. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
4 minutes. Perfect. Okay. You ready?
Oh, yes. I'm ready. Thank you.
Justice Bell, you ready as well?
Yes.
All right. Ms. Reynolds, you can proceed.
Thank you. There was one person in the house on the night in question who was two things. Who was both familiar with Clayton Davis, who knew Clayton Davis, and who was present in the room when John Whitaker was stabbed. That person was Rick Caravo. And Mr. Caravo was the only person to definitively make a statement that Clayton Davis stabbed John Whitaker. That statement was never subject to cross-examination because Mr. Caravo died before trial. The statement, Mr. Davis will concede, it was not testimonial per se. So therefore, as we discussed in the briefing, the standard of review for this claim is an abuse of discretion. However, in looking at the exception to the hearsay rule and in interpreting whether or not the district court abused its discretion in allowing this statement, I think this court's analysis has to be informed by the Confrontation Clause. Now, generally under the Confrontation Clause, it's satisfied if a statement has an adequate indicia of reliability. And that includes those statements that fall within a firmly rooted hearsay exception. However,
let me interrupt you to ask you, how is the Confrontation Clause issue not waived?
Because I think there was absolutely an objection. There was briefing on the issue of whether or not this statement should come in. And what Mr. Davis is arguing now is that in interpreting the excited utterance exception, the purpose of those exceptions, they exist because they're inherently reliable. And it's the Confrontation Clause that requires that those statements be inherently reliable. So what we're saying is not that this was a Confrontation Clause violation. We're saying simply that this was hearsay and it should not fall under the excited, and it does not fall under the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule. And that issue was clearly preserved at the district court level.
So I get the argument on that. So are you abandoning the Confrontation Clause issue? I'm a little unclear.
So whether I am saying that independently there was Confrontation Clause violation here, no.
Okay.
So to the extent that issue was raised, yes. What I am saying is that when you're interpreting the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule, you have to keep in mind the Confrontation Clause and the purposes for those exceptions, which is that they're inherently reliable. And so,
well, I guess one of the reasons that I was raising it, unlike the Diaz case, right, where there was an objection made to a hearsay issue, and the court, this court, kind of said, look, the objection was based on the unavailability of the declarant. Here, the objection and the offer was all about an excited utterance. The availability of the declarant is immaterial in that respect, right? It's about whether it was an excited utterance or not an excited utterance. So arguably, you don't get to the Confrontation Clause issue in the way that you would in the Diaz case. That's why I was curious as to whether what your position was going to be on whether it was waived below and whether it's something you're pursuing here or if the focus is simply on excited utterance.
The focus is primarily on the excited utterance, though the simple fact exists that Mr. Whitaker was clearly unavailable. He had died.
Okay.
Do you think that perhaps there was plain error, or should we engage in plain error review or de novo review of the Confrontation Clause issue?
To the extent this court wishes to engage in plain error or de novo review, Mr. Davis would certainly welcome it. But I think here it is plain enough under the simple abuse of discretion standard that the admission of this statement was error.
But if we were to say that the Confrontation Clause was in play, would the statement made be testimonial in nature or non-testimonial or testimonial in nature, and why, you know, why do you say that?
Interestingly here, the statement as it was made to Ms. Lister was not testimonial. However, Mr. Caraveau, and let me back up a little bit. So just to put on the record, under NRS 51095, to be an excited utterance, it has to be a statement relating to a startling event or condition made while the declarant was under the stress of the excitement caused by that event, and that it relates to that event. So two separate requirements. Here, Mr. Caraveau, I think Ms. Lister's testimony indicated that he was certainly agitated. He was certainly excited. However, somehow Mr. Whitaker had been moved from the living room to the garage, possibly with Mr. Caraveau's help. He was busy. He was cleaning up his house. He was taking steps to run. He had, in fact, run by the time that the police arrived. There was an outstanding warrant for his arrest. So had he done the right thing here? Had, when his good friend had been stabbed, instead of leaving him in the garage, Ms. Lister found Mr. Whitaker alone in the garage when she came out of the bedroom. Mr. Caraveau was in the kitchen cleaning up an active crime scene. Now, had he done the right thing? Had he called 911? Had he stayed with his friend? Had he made the statement then to the police when they were interviewing him about what had happened here? That statement would have been testimonial. And under Crawford, that would not have come in. However, instead of that, he made the choice to convey that information to Ms. Lister before he ran. So for whatever reason, for whatever purpose, he, while he was cleaning, came out to the garage and told her that Clayton Davis is the person who stabbed John Whitaker. So if you look at the case law in the briefing, a lot of it looks at the issue of whether or not there was time for independent reflection or determination. So is this the law school hearsay exception for the excited utterance? Ouch, that hurts. Was this a spontaneous explanation or exclamation, or was this something that you gave some thought to? Because if there's been thought, if there's been reflection, if there's been decision, you can be agitated, you can be upset, but that's no longer an excited utterance. And I think if you look at Medina, it's interesting, and I know the state cites Medina pretty extensively. However, under Medina, what's interesting is that the court even specifically says that you have to look at all of the facts and circumstances surrounding a statement. So in Medina, the victim had been attacked. It had been at least somewhere between, I think, 12 and 24 hours after she was attacked that a neighbor came to the door, knocked. She answered the door in a clear state of shock. She hadn't changed her clothes. She was still covered in blood and said, "I've been raped." The court said that was an excited utterance. But again, they said that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. She had made no efforts to get help, to clean herself up. She was clearly in a state of shock. Now, in here, Mr. Caraveau is reacting. But what he's reacting to is his knowledge that the police are going to be coming and that he does not want to be there when they arrive. So this is not a situation where he has made a spontaneous statement. This is a situation where he's made a calculated decision to convey information to Ms. Lister. And that's not inherently reliable. And that is what the excited utterance exception is supposed to provide for, a statement that is reliable. This is not. Now, looking at the other people who were present in that house that night, Ms. Lister did not know Clayton Davis. She testified multiple times that this all happened so fast. She struggled to give any details about the attacker to responding officers. All she could come up with the night of the attack was, "It all happened so fast. I'm not sure it was two natives." Now,
what do you think our test should be for reliability of in-court identification when there hasn't been a prior identification.
I'm so sorry. I misheard the first part of that sentence.
It's okay. When we have an in-court identification and there's never been a prior identification, what do you think the test should be?
The test should be similar for if there is an out-of-court identification. So that night, say officers had taken Ms. Lister to, had captured Clayton Davis, had driven Ms. Lister somewhere and said, is this the guy? This court under Taylor would have said that that was not inherently reliable, and then they would have had to analyze whether or not there was an exigency. So whether there was a reason that the show up needed to happen. In this case, when you're looking, an in-court identification under these circumstances, it's essentially no different than a show-up identification. You're sitting a defendant at a table. In this case, he was the only Native American man sitting in the well of the court. He was sitting in between two female defense attorneys. How is that any different? How does that not throw the weight of the state behind that identification any less than showing Ms. Lister a man in handcuffs at a show-up and saying, is this the guy? If anything, it's more prejudicial. It's showing that the entire weight of the state and the prosecution, that the state believes they have found the person, and that they are putting all their weight into a prosecution of this person. So I think, again, there should not be a first-time in-court identification unless the state can show that there is a need, so there's a necessity for that identification, and that identification is not inherently suggestive, so the person knew the person already. In the alternative...
You're proposing that we would essentially foreclose witnesses or victims from coming to court and identifying somebody unless they knew that person or had somehow engaged in a prior out-of-court identification.
Yes, or the state could show that for some or any reason that a prior out-of-court identification, whether it be a photo array, an in-person array, something that I think we can acknowledge that all case law has shown to be a more reliable identification, is impracticable or cannot occur. In the alternative, and then I would reserve the remainder of my time, I would submit that if this court chooses not to do that, then at a minimum, I think it was an abuse of discretion for the district court in this case to not give the identification instruction that was requested by the defense that listed out those factors in Taylor that do show whether or not, that tend to suggest whether or not an identification is reliable. It was the Taylor factors that were submitted in that defense jury instruction, and it was a correct statement of the law. It was Mr. Davis's theory of the case that he had been misidentified by Ms. Lister. So therefore, given all of the other briefing on the identification issue, we would submit that it was an abuse of discretion to not give that jury instruction. And I would reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you. All right, Ms. Kate.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Marilee Kate, and I represent the state of Nevada in this case. Before I jump into the legal issues, I do want to make some factual corrections. Ms. Reynolds began by saying there's only one other person in the house that night that knew Davis, and that's not true. Ms. Currup testified, this is at 700, page 700 to 702 in the record, that she had seen Mr. Davis at her house previously. She knew him from around town. She was familiar with Mr. Davis. And her testimony, I want to talk about just a little bit more before I jump into the issues, but that night, she was an eyewitness to both the burglary and the murder. And she testified that, and the evidence came out, that essentially she left the residence. She couldn't find the phone that she was using, Mr. Caravu's phone, and she left the residence to call 911. And so she wasn't in the same house with Mr. Caravu or Ms. Lister when those Mr. Caravu's statement was being made. But what's important is as she's leaving, she talks to Jay Thomas, her other roommate, who was not out in the room when the murder occurred, But she tells him it was Clay Davis that was at the house that night. Then she gets to her friend's house. They call 911. On the 911 call, a lot was made at trial by defense that, you know, you didn't identify Clay Davis on the 911 call. And what Ms. Caribou says is, I want to talk to somebody in person. And you could tell through testimony, she talks about how she didn't want to be identifying anybody. She didn't want to be involved in this.
Corrupt, sorry.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. Ms. Corrupt, thank you for that correction. And so she talks about how she didn't want to identify anybody, but the responding officer gets there and she says it's Clay Davis. She also, that's on body cam. The jury got to watch that. Also, in her written statement that night that she prepared, she talked about the Jeep Cherokee, which is kind of an important corroborating detail in this case. But she also said, I believe it was Clay Davis, and no idea who the other Native guy is. Clay pulled a kitchen knife and said, I'm going to stab you. And then John said, you already did. And I ran out the door. Came back in when they were taking off. I seen blood on the kitchen floor. John was laying on the garage floor. That's a statement she made the night of the event. Her identification of Mr. Davis has been consistent throughout. And something else important, factually, I think this court could consider is, you know, there's been a lot of this, the argument mostly related to Mr. Caribou and Ms. Lister that they're unreliable witnesses and things like that. I think reliability is a jury determination. I think we know that. But I think there is evidence in this record, or at least an indication in this record, that the jury found Ms. Caribou's testimony credible. Because
Ms. Carup?
Ms. Carup.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Caribou, right? I just want to make sure I'm not missing a character in this story. Okay.
No, you're right. And I'm Ms. Carup. I apologize. And what's important, though, is that the jury found Mr. Davis guilty of burglary. And really, it's Ms. Corrupt's testimony. There's a little bit related to E.J. Creighton that talks about kind of Mr. Davis's knowledge that there's drugs and money at that house, the two prior instances where he's present. But Ms. Caribou, no, Ms. Carup, she talks about how Davis was uninvited that night. He came in. He immediately escalated things with Mr. Caribou. He demanded that Ms. Corrupt and Mr. Caribou empty their pockets. She emptied her pockets. She remembers only a tampon being there. Tampons later found on the dining room table where she talked about this occurring. Davis, you know, he's using force. It's supporting the state's theory. He's knocking Mr. Caribou's phone out of her hand. Then he's brandishing a weapon. She sees the knife. She talks about how Mr. Davis is the only one that has a knife that night. And then Mr. Whitaker and Ms. Lister come in, and then Davis rushes them. And then that's when the murder occurs. And Davis does demand again that they empty the pockets. And I think another important point about that burglary is one of the things that Davis is demanding is that dope. I want dope, right? That's a fact that came out. So again, when this court's looking at this case and kind of the state of the evidence, I think Ms. Corrupt's testimony is really important to keep in mind, because she did know Davis from before, and she did ID him consistently throughout the case. And so a point I do want to make about Mr. Caribou's, you know, the excited utterance argument is about timing, and I think I could have been a little bit more clear in my briefing, that there's surveillance footage that shows the Jeep, Mr. Houston's Jeep, showing up in the area at 10:40 p.m., Ms. Lister's call to 911 was at 10:44 p.m., and then paramedics arrive at 10:50. We are talking about a very tight window where Mr. Caribou's statement could have occurred, and I think, you know, related to kind of this court's consideration, it was spontaneous. He wasn't made in response to the 911 call. As Ms. Reynolds talks about, he's in and out. He's throwing a towel to Ms. Lister, trying to calm her a little bit, but Ms. Lister talked about how there wasn't a time for them to talk. He's trying to calm her down, but he's certainly not calm. He's frantic. Ms. Lister, who knows Mr. Caribou's, you know, saying that he was panicked, but that panic started before Ms. Lister called 911. There's this whole argument that it's related to his warrant and things like that, and I just don't think that bore out in the evidence in this case. This was a spontaneous statement made. It was made in the course of an ongoing emergency. That's kind of like the Harkins case. I cited Harkins mostly related to confrontation in my brief, but I think Harkins has, is very similar as the statement was made in response to actually 911 operator's questions, but it was during an ongoing emergency. At this point, when this statement was made, Mr. Whitaker is still laying on the floor. He's still bleeding. Mr. Whitaker did not, paramedics arrived. They tried to take him to Renown. He passed away in Sparks. So he's still alive. There's testimony about him mumbling while the statement is occurring. I think all those things relate, go to the kind of ongoing emergency. I think another interesting point is, you know, the district court's assessment of Ms. Lister and how she relayed these facts at trial and its own credibility determination about her and what she was saying. Because before this came in, the district court made a comment that, you know, it was a close call. It's a close call. And then he heard her testimony. And then the district court said he termed her testimony powerful. The statement was inherently reliable based on, he said it was powerful to be in this courtroom with her while she was testifying. And so I think that's important. The district court's view of it shifted based on his assessment of the witness.
So Ms. Kate, speaking of Ms. Lister, do you have thoughts on what is the appropriate test for a first-time in-court identification?
Absolutely. I wasn't sure if you had an additional part there, so I was waiting a second. Yes. So I do. I think that Perry, the SCOTUS case from 2012, talks about how no additional preliminary requirements are required. If law enforcement isn't involved, if there's no improper state conduct, the Perry court talked about how a preliminary check or screening isn't necessary. And so that would be the state's position to maintain that. And part of the rationale from Perry is really that the inherent safeguards in the system, cross-examination, availability of expert witnesses to come in and testify, all which occurred here, counsel argument, those all protect against any concerns related to first-time eyewitness identification, because counsel can really ferret that out. And I included a footnote in my brief because I think counsel did a very good job in this case, really highlighting some of those concerns. Now, you know, we also have Ms. Carup's testimony, so, you know, that also supports kind of corroborating Ms. Lister's ID. But I was a little confused when you asked about a test from Davis's counsel, because there was a reference to the out-of-court test, which I think in Nevada we look at whether the ID was suggestive and then whether it was reliable. But then there was reference to, I think, what's really the Creighton test, which is one of the minority state positions, because there was talk about, you know, and I think Justice Hernan, you pointed on this, is that it would essentially foreclose certain victims from coming in, because you would really limit a first-time ID based on the idea that it was like a show-up, and if there wasn't another opportunity to do an ID, then we wouldn't let it in. And so I think the court, there's many reasons, I cited them in my brief, of why you shouldn't adopt that super minority position, that Creighton, I think, test that comes out of either Connecticut or Massachusetts, but that you should really just not require any pre-screening on this type of scenario. But if you were to, and you were to adopt a test about like an out of court, consider that you know, whether it's suggestive, whether it's reliable. I think this case meets that, particularly because suggestive wise, this wasn't a circumstance where the prosecutor said, you know, over at the defensive table, do you recognize anybody over there, Ms. Lister? That didn't happen. The prosecutor said, do you see the person in the courtroom today? Very innocuous, not trying to point to that person, you know, not inherently suggestive that that has to be the person. And then I think it's also...
Ms. Kate, though, I mean, you have to agree, though, that identifying somebody in court typically is... it's fairly obvious who is supposed to be identified.
Sure, but I think the Perry case and even Domina from the Ninth Circuit talk about how that fact alone doesn't require any additional checks by courts in advance. And I think, you know, Domina talks about it, the Ninth Circuit talks about it as, this is just eyewitness evidence is important evidence, sure. But it's like any other evidence. And it doesn't go to the inherent nature and the importance of, you know, like counsel at trial or things like that. And so I think, yes, it is. I think the courts have recognized that, sure, it is strong evidence for the state. But at the same time, they've recognized that the Constitution doesn't require any additional protections under these circumstances, where there isn't some law enforcement conduct or, you know, some bad act on the part of the state, essentially.
Let me ask you, Ms. Kate, because I apologize if it was in there and I've either forgotten or I didn't write a note on it. But I know that there was testimony from Ms. The trial occurred approximately 4 years after the homicide. Ms. Lister testified about seeing the defendant's picture on the news at some point and saying, that's him, they got the guy. When was that in relation to the homicide?
So it was very close to the time of arrest. So he wasn't arrested right at on the night of the homicide. He was arrested a few days later, I think is the facts, in a car. He was laying down in the back of the car and was arrested. And then his photo was put on the news.
So within a week?
Within a week. I mean, we're talking less than 2 weeks for sure. But I think within a week.
Yeah, I know your time is ticking down. I wanted to get one question in before you sat down. I was wondering about this impeachment of Danielson with the prior order in order to discredit Danielson's testimony as an expert. It appears to me that the judge made the threshold determination or under Hallmark regarding the qualifications of this expert, but then didn't really go into the Petrocelli analysis. And I'm struggling with the relevance of the prior order, which dealt with the NMS lab, which he no longer was employed at, versus here in this case, it was about DNA interpretation. So I'm struggling to understand, you know, first I think it is slightly prejudicial to impeach the expert in that way. Do you have any statements about that to alleviate my concerns?
Sure. I don't think it's actual prior bad act testimony, so I don't think Petrocelli is required because it's impeachment of an expert. I think that the Hill case, it's an unpublished from this court, but more recent, it's in civil, but talks about impeaching the credibility of the expert. I think this court has long recognized impeaching credibility is something you can vigorously do with experts. I would also say that Dr. Danielson did say that he was actually still, he wasn't on the board, but I think his testimony was that, in kind of the rebuttal, was that, hey, he hasn't changed any practices because of this. He still does the same things. They do the same thing. He got in actually a lot of information that the judge essentially didn't know what they were talking about. In the rebuttal, there's about 10 pages worth of questions dedicated to that, kind of rehabilitating him. But I think when you look at his testimony, and I know I'm definitely ticking down here, but you look at his testimony, this is not a full DNA case, right? The DNA that's really important for the state in this case was that it was on the knife sheath in the house. But he didn't disagree with that necessarily. He excluded Mr. Davis from the knife and from things like that, but we don't even know that, you know, it's the knife looked like it could be what was used in this case. There was testimony that a knife was discarded by Mr. Houston and all of that, but we don't know for sure. And so when you look at his testimony on, you know, and what he was impeached on, this isn't a DNA case where the DNA was central, and he did agree about the DNA specific to the state's that issue. I think his exclusion, you know, where he differed is he would exclude, may I conclude?
Yes, please.
He did exclude on Davis from certain things, but those are things that the Washoe County Crime Lab didn't necessarily say Davis was there. They said a mixture, and we can't make any determinations. So I don't think that the test of his testimony wasn't the main focus of this case. And if I just may briefly, Your Honor, do a final thought.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
I'm going to give Ms. Reynolds some extra time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I think the issues in this case, if you think about them, Ms. Lister and Mr. Caribou's statements, there's other independent testimony about Davis being the perpetrator. So they're cumulative. So if this court considers any error on anything, I think that it should find that it was really cumulative Ms. Corrupt's testimony. And then with respect to the experts, those are kind of minute kind of details that weren't necessarily as important to the state's case, given the other eyewitness testimony, then it wasn't DNA. And I'd also just say that, you know, this case is not one where there was any misconduct on the part of the state. I think the evidence is overwhelming. And I don't think these errors really had an impact in the fundamental fairness of this trial. And so I'd ask that you affirm the judgments of conviction. Thank you.
Justice Bell, any other questions?
No.
Okay. Julie, would you add a minute and 20 seconds to Ms. Reynolds' time as well?
Thank you. With respect to Ms. Kirup, yes, she was there at the house at the beginning of the altercation. She was also, there was some testimony that she had been staying at the house at the time, that she was absolutely a friend of Mr. Caravo's. And her testimony, frankly, between different statements, it was all over the place. When asked if Mr. Davis had a knife with him, Ms. Kirup said, I believe so. I'm not too sure. I can't, like, actually. I just got a glimpse of it when, like, it was at the table, but I'm not too sure. She did not see a stabbing. And she left the house. And then she testified that there was a burglary, and then she left the house. So the defense position throughout trial was twofold, that Ms. Kirup was not reliable and that she had not been there for the stabbing itself. So we would submit that the value of Ms. Kirup's statements as accumulating or corroborating is extremely limiting. With respect to the Dr. Danielson issue, a couple things. First, and why the defense believes that really, and I think it came through in the trial transcript, that there had been discussion. It was known to the parties that this turning order existed pre-trial. It was known a couple of years pre-trial. It was discussed in pleadings. There was a hearing, and then as acknowledged by the district court, the state had indicated that it wasn't planning to use it. That happened in the discussion at trial. That was acknowledged by the state. Why that's important is that if you look at the tourney order, it's a critique of work that was done, testing that was done by NMS labs. The testing in this case was performed by the Washoe County Crime Lab. So this is Dr. Danielson interpreting the results of the Washoe County Crime Lab versus lab work that's actually done by NMS labs. And then afterwards, there was a study that was commissioned by NMS labs with the accrediting agency that found that their practices were solid, they were grounded in solid science, and that they did not need to change their practices. And what's interesting is here is that Judge Dixon's comments, and really what is offensive and was plain error, is that the state was able to read into the record some scathing comments of Judge Dixon, direct quotes. You know, did Judge Dixon say this, that NMS labs, you know, that your conclusions were not grounded in good science, were stretched the limits of credibility? Yes. So that's an additional layer of error. That, yes, specific instances of misconduct, had the court found that those were relevant under Petrocelli, could have been inquired into on cross-examination. This was more than inquiring, Dr. Danielson, have you ever been found by a court to be unreliable? Has your testimony ever not been allowed by a court? That would be an inquiry into an extrinsic, into an instance of alleged misconduct. This is allowing...
Yes. I'm so sorry. Do you think that it makes a difference that he's an expert, though, because typically we treat expert impeachment a little bit differently?
I think there should be vigorous impeachment of expert witnesses. I won't dispute that at all. But I think in this case, with this complicated of an issue where there was this order that everyone knew existed, that there had been contemplation that there would be a Petrocelli hearing if the state wanted to get into it. In that case, it was error on the seventh day of trial to all of a sudden allow that in. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Ms.